The defense for Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev has been presenting the jury with a social history of the Tsarnaev family. Today, in day 27, the defense turned to their ethnic homeland of Chechnya, and the jury heard how that history influenced the psychiatric well-being of Zahar's father and how his older brother, Tamerlan, became unhinged and abusive. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Why don't we start with the father, Ansar Tsarnaev? I thought there's some interesting stuff about him today.
Yeah, there was a psychiatrist named Dr. Alexander Niss, who's a Russian, but he came here to America in the 90s, and he ended up in a residency at St. Elizabeth Hospital here in Brighton, and he treated Ansar. Ansar Tsarnaev came in and obviously had all sorts of issues. Within a week or so of being seen twice, he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress.
A very sick guy.
Yeah.
And the doctor
then went through this lengthy trial and error procedure in which the doctor was prescribing a combination of antipsychotic and mood stabilizers and just trying to figure out what he could do to help Ansar. You know, Ansar Tsarnaev was a very ill person. If you're a juror sitting there, you're saying, what exactly does this have to do with Zahar Tsarnaev?
But the defense has said the jurors need to hear things in context, and that context would be the social history. So what you're talking about with Alexander Niss are the symptoms from what he identifies and what Ansar himself reveals about his past. So we find out that when he was a child, he had had a head trauma, he had some seizures. But what really comes out of this, and the revelation here, is that he said he was tortured in a concentration camp involving the Russian-Chechen War. For the first war broke out in 1994, that he was in a concentration camp organized by Russian soldiers. And among the symptoms, besides the anxiety, the panic attack, flashbacks, Dr. Niss indicates in his records that he, Ansar, vividly saw hallucinations, that he's going through paranoia, that he sees KGB agents looking at him through his windows in Cambridge.
Both before and after this testimony, you saw the defense trying to establish the Chechen diaspora, and that even though the family really were not from Chechnya, they had witnesses explaining that, you know, once you are ethnic Chechen, you are from that culture, you are from those traditions, and the traditions that come from Chechnya stay with you even if you're in that diaspora, even if part of that diaspora lands you in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Kevin, if we had a kind of a spotlight to put theatrical light on you right now with a kind of a black background, you could be one of the speakers in the PBS documentary, I'm imagining, The Chechens, because that's what we had today. It's fascinating. And first of all, having been in that area, you've been over there near the Caucasus, the fact that these are mountain peoples, all of these mountain peoples, the Chechens, Dagestan, in Abkhazia, they're in the mountains and they're like island cultures, separate and apart. And so they brought in a Princeton professor today, Michael Reynolds. He was talking about the fact that you have two challenges. You need social cohesion in these places. There's no central rule.
Right.
And you need self-protection. It means the community has to stick together because often in these mountain villages, there aren't very many people. And that self-protection involves rules and codes of behavior.
Yeah, and central to the defense point in this is that the Chechens have a patriarchal society and that the father is, you know, the leader of the family and what he says goes. And if the father is either incapacitated or dead, that goes to the oldest son in the family and or an older uncle. And this goes hand in hand with the sort of the incapacitation of Ansar for mental health reasons, is that it fell to Tamerlan. And Tamerlan, the brother who was killed shortly after the bombings and that shootout with police, Tamerlan, for all intents and purposes, becomes the leader of that family. The other thing that was effective in all this, I think, testimony is showing that the parents kind of checked out We heard testimony from people that were classmates of Jahar in high school. We heard from his wrestling coach the idea that he was the captain of the wrestling team, but the parents never showed up to a meet. They never showed up on senior night. They just weren't there for him. And so that's the defense wants this image. The parents are gone, and in this patriarchal society, Jahar is answerable, even at 19 years of age, to this 26-year-old brother who is absolutely unhinged, who has absolutely gone the way down of jihad.
All true, but I want to go back to the documentary, Kevin. I want to go
Part 9, The Chechens.
I want to go a little deeper here, because really what the defense wants to get to is this historical injustice, this trauma in Chechen society. The Princeton professor took it back 1944. The entire country is deported by Stalin 2,000 miles away. They eventually are allowed to come back, those who can do it. Then you shift quickly to the 1990s, early 90s. The Soviet Union breaks up, and Chechnya, this fiercely independent little place that's never had a lot of control on it, now wants to be independent. Mm-hmm. And Yeltsin invades in 1994. And interestingly enough, one of Anzor Zanayev's heroes is somebody named Jahar Dudayev. He is a former Russian Air Force general who was taken over in Chechnya, and he leads the revolt, the nationalist revolt against the Russians. 50 to 100,000 people
killed.
And that is all fought in Chechnya. But what's interesting, that's a nationalist fight. Mm-hmm. The Second War breaks out in 1999, and Dudayev himself had started bringing in the Mujahideen, the Islamicists. And now the 1999 war becomes much more of a proxy war of Islam and jihad versus the Christians.
The other thing that was really interesting in that history explained out is when they talked about Al-Khattab, the Saudi native who actually came in to fight in Chechnya. And Khattab actually was really way ahead of his time. He was the first jihadi who decided to film his own battles. And these became propaganda. And if you fast forward, it's that kind of propaganda, the idea of that somebody can be radicalized online, reading this stuff, looking at pictures of atrocities, looking at jihadis fighting in the mountains. This is exactly the way that Tamerlan Zanayev and then his younger brother became radicalized.
Now, the prosecution sees red at this. There was a sidebar yesterday, and the proceedings were transcribed and actually released today. And in that sidebar, William Weinreb, the federal prosecutor, was complaining to the judge, the only thing relevant here is evidence that bears on Jahar Zanayev's moral culpability for the crime. Which is to say, why are we talking about Chechnya? And this was Michael Reynolds of Princeton University's first experience as a paid witness at a trial. And I think he might have been a little disillusioned.
This ain't the academy.
It ain't the academy. You make a nice piece of change by coming in. Nobody can interrupt you except for your leading lawyer who's fawning over you. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, you're going to be cross-examined. So under cross-examination, Weinreb takes him on today, and he takes him on directly. He says, wouldn't you say that the world has changed a lot in the last few thousand years? But then, with a particular disdain, says, you do realize that Tamerlan Zanayev was never born in Chechnya, never lived there. That you do realize that Jahar Zanayev was never born or raised there. You do realize that the father, Anzor, was never born or raised there.
Well, I think the government is clearly frustrated over the issue of relevance here, and we can only wonder if the jurors are wondering the same thing. But also, it kind of brings me back to this thing, and we've talked about this too, David, is that, you know, buying time can be somewhat tactical. And when the penalty phase ended from the government's point of view, the animus towards Jahar Zanayev in that courtroom was palpable. I think if you said, okay, you want to kill him now? I think there just was an incredible feeling of emotion after all that stuff. So a lot of what the defense is doing is literally playing for time. They are playing this out. But, you know, the government brought this on once they made it a death penalty case. I'm sure the defense believes all of this is relevant. Sitting there as a neutral, objective observer, I wonder how much of it is. But the bottom line is they are doing what they are supposed to do. Mitigation means you can throw anything up there and see if it sticks.
And the court is obligated to give the defense all opportunities to present mitigation. I think, though, this is strong, and going back to that second Chechnya war in which it becomes a proxy war, all of a sudden it goes up online. All that stuff is in Chechnya now, becomes jihad, world jihad.
Right.
And so even though, as you had suggested earlier, well, why didn't the Tsarnaevs attack Russia? Through that experience of the Second War, in which it's all conflated, they could be attacking the Americans because the Americans are the kafir, the infidels, and defined by what happened in Chechnya.
You know, the other thing I must say, David, and I remember in the first phase of the guilt phase of the trial, Judge O'Toole said, I do not want to hear anybody say the words Iraq or Afghanistan until later. We haven't heard that yet.
No, there have been a series, and it's pretty clear, especially today in the testimony, there have been a series of adverse rulings against the defense in which all of a sudden we're expecting to hear things.
It ends.
Yeah. They have not been able to go any farther. And that happened, by the way, today on a particular point, the murder of Brendan Mess, a friend of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. It came out in the questioning of one of Zhihar's.
That's Zamparelli.
That's right. One of his friends from high school, that her boyfriend lived across from the house of Brendan Mess. Brendan Mess is important to this story, ultimately, because he's one of three homicide victims in Waltham, and in which Tamerlan was named as the main assailant by one of Tamerlan's friends, who was later shot to death during a police investigation with the FBI. So now we are stretching almost as far as Kazakhstan is from Chechnya and talking about this, but there are lots of strands here.
Relevance was the issue that this did not get further down the road. But from the defense point of view, they desperately want the jury to be aware that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was the suspect in those murders. Police believe he was one of the killers of those three men. And that would go a long way in making their point that this was 2 years before the bombings. He was homicidal. He was a killer 2 years before this happened. And that's crucial for the defense to let the jury know that. But I don't think they're going to know that.
Yeah, I think it's been well established, not only that he was the lead agent here, he was the perpetrator. But once again, today, we get an illustration in a small way of what a loathsome human being he was.
Yeah, in this case, there's a woman named Amanda Ransom. She was the college roommate of Catherine Russell, who would become the wife of Tamerlan's and I have and bear his child. Amanda Ransom said that when Catherine and Tamerlan were dating, there was this situation which they had sex, and she could hear Catherine crying. And what had happened is that Tamerlan told Catherine that he had AIDS. And she was crying, and when she cried, he laughed at her.
It was a great joke.
It was supposed to be a joke. So, I mean, you can't think of a more loathsome thing than that. It fits right in with everything we've been led to believe about Tamerlan. And yet again, it comes back to, you know, what does this have to do with the guilt or the culpability of Zhihar Tsarnaev when it comes to the Boston Marathon bombings? I know people are frustrated the last couple of days. I think people feel like this is starting to go on longer than necessary, but in the end, Zhihar Tsarnaev's lawyers are trying to save his life, not our time.
Yeah. That's the end of Day 27. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boer.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Join us again tomorrow as the defense continues.
Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at BostonGlobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.